Welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities in London. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. In this interview, while on a walk around St James's Park in London on a bright lunchtime in January, I talked to Dr. William Bird, a practicing family doctor who in the mid-1990s hatched the concept of prescribing health walks, and he shares with us how his vision for a national adoption of this has evolved. Tell me what got you into this walking thing. What was the sort of reason for getting involved?
Okay, Andrew, I mean, it really did start almost down to one month in July 1994. I was a GP at Sunning Common, and I was doing my diabetic clinic. And in the diabetic clinic, every 6 months, the same people used to come back saying, oh, they'd love to do some more exercise, but they can't do it, and they're too overweight, and they don't like sport, and they don't like swimming, and they don't like fitness and gyms. And I said, oh dear, well, see if you can try and take up some sport or something. But it was hopeless. They didn't do anything. So I went out in a slight kind of disillusioned mood and went for a walk. It was a lovely July evening, and took my dog for a walk right around the houses where they lived. Beautiful, open, but totally empty footpaths. And I thought, this is crazy. These people are saying they can't exercise because there's nothing to do. And yet, out here, we've got massive resource and it's not being used. And that's where we developed some maps. And that was the very first start of really the walking.
Was there anything else before that in your life, in your childhood or anything? Were you a family of walkers themselves?
We've always been outdoors. My dad's been a doctor, and my mother was a naturalist. So there's obviously a very strong link there. So I've always had an outside and enjoyed nature, and it's always helped me to relax and de-stress after a very difficult day. So that background, I think, obviously had a huge impact.
Yeah, during that time, since 1994, you've been involved in lots of very influential stuff. You've sort of stepped out of the GP surgery. You've kept one foot in.
Yeah, I'm still half-time GP.
Can you try and explain what was the desire to... Did you want to shed yourself of being a GP and get involved in something else?
Not at all. I would love to carry on being a full-time GP, to be honest, but I can't fit everything in. So I'm very proud to be a GP. I think it's one of the kind of real pure professional jobs where you really have got the skills which you build up over years and years. And that's why I don't want to stop doing it. So I do half-time, albeit at night and weekends. But this, I felt, was more important in changing a lifestyle of a whole nation rather than just my individual patients. But the individual patients keep me very firmly grounded.
How did one set of health walks in Sunning Common trigger a national initiative which has affected hundreds of thousands of people?
When it started, it was very, very much for those patients in the diabetic clinic, and that's where the kind of the origin, all the energy was driven. But what we found is that just producing maps didn't do anything. People didn't know what they meant or didn't use them. So we had to take people out onto these walks, show them where the footpaths were. And we suddenly realised that actually people needed to be taught how to walk. It was a skill that had been lost, an art form that had been lost, and they need to be reintroduced to it. And that was a fundamental shift of realising how far we had to do to change the culture. So when the maps came out and nothing happened, we got the local volunteers to lead some walks, and we started off with a big bang of 9 walks a week right from day one in April 1995. And then I was trying to get money for it. I spent a long time because nobody was really interested. They say walking's just too boring, it's nothing to do with health really. I even got that comment from some parts of the Department of Health. And so we had to scrape for 500 quid here and build it up, and Wokingham were interested, but so was the Countryside Commission. And the Countryside Commission wanted to get more people out for their health. And they put a lot more money into it, along with the British Heart Foundation, who we brought in to work with the Countryside Commission. And then that got to a lottery funding of about 6 million. And then really the whole thing moved on at a different gear. But we did need to get all the evaluation. So a lot of research was done through Oxford Brookes University to underpin the effect of it, to show it was real rather than just perceived.
You made it sound really simple.
but it was just a easy flow steps. You just got a few volunteers in, you contacted various people and brought them in. But okay, there's a lot more to it, which shows that you've got a lot more skills in being an influencer and maybe even a charmer, and charmed all these people. So what, you know, what processes did you have to go through to get make this happen?
I think the first thing is it was just very hard work. It was staying up till 2 or 3 every single morning for almost 3 years to fit into a normal family life of young children and general practice. This was all on top. Nobody was paying me. I had no remit. I had no money. I had no staff. I had no time. And therefore, it was very, very hard work. And what I think the important thing is, people had to buy this vision. They had to believe in what you were doing and what I was doing, and to believe that this was the right way forward. And that has been the big difference. It's really influencing people and helping them to share your vision.
You've not only got them walking, but you've got people maintaining the footpaths they walk. So can you talk a little bit about where did the idea of the Green Gym come from?
Green Gym came very soon after the health walks. BTCV had been trying to get more people out doing conservation work, and they wanted to show people that there were lots of health benefits. So the Green Gym was a kind of combination. In fact, the name came from a pub visit we did with BTCV guy and myself, thinking out what we're going to call it. And it was to look at the environment, and this was pushing, although we were selling health walks very much with the cardiovascular effect in order to buy it into the NHS, the Green Gym was one step probably further back, as far as the medics were concerned, of looking at the environment and how the environment was important. And at that point, it was very, very kind of new age stuff, and very, very tricky to kind of make the balance of real good medicine and the environment. But we set it up to try and improve the environment so that more people could go out and walk, and families could go out and on footpaths which weren't completely overgrown, and that they'd actually be able to work in the natural environment, connect with it. And it seemed to attract a very different group from a health walks. Health walks is 2/3 women, 1/3 men, and that stayed exactly the same for the last 12 years. Green Gym is 2/3 men, 1/3 women, and has probably got much more of the mental health benefits. It's probably not quite so intense on the social side. People can just be a little bit isolated if they want to. So it's attracted a different group of people.
Do you know the numbers of people who've been involved with the Green Gyms?
There are 95 Green Gyms at the moment. Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales, England, all involved. There's a franchise out in Australia, so Green Gyms are now starting out there as well, and they've been very successful. And other franchises were hoping to start. And you can get one probably fairly nearby where you live if you go onto the website of btcv.org.uk, and it's /Green Gym. And then just put your postcode in and they'll tell you where they are. We're hoping that they're going to expand rapidly and take on other organisations that do conservation work, so that it widens the scope for it. So we don't want just 95, that's just not enough. We want at least 2,000 or 3,000 Green Gyms around, so that every community, every town, every village has a Green Gym that's improving the environment, and actually the community themselves are looking after their own environment.
And presently, is it a GP that prescribes you to a Green Gym?
You can just turn up. It may suit you, it may not. And it depends. And one group might suit you, and you might go down the road to another Green Gym and find that much more acceptable. Very few GPs actually recommend it. And this is one thing we're really trying to put right. The Department of Health are launching a big physical activity plan, and the idea is to link general practice with both Green Gyms and health walks, and in fact Blue Gym, which is going to be using coastal access and coastal walking as well. So we're hoping there's a very much bigger tie-in now between the Department of Health, NHS and all these activities.
It's a bit strange that these things aren't connected already, and that it's taken you more than 10 years to get changes going on.
I know, and this is really strange, because patients immediately, and when I say patients, I talk as a doctor here, will understand it straight away. GPs are still looking at diseases. That's what we're trained to do. And we're looking at diagnosis and treatment, and we need that. We need someone to make the right diagnosis. But they see Green Gyms and health walks as being just out of their reach, really. And it's just not quite in, I have to say, even their comfort zone of what they should be referring. And often they can't find any information about where it is nearby, and that's a fault of the health walks. So the medical profession is getting there, but it's still a long way behind the public.
Are we in a good position that the politicians recognise the value of health walks and green gyms?
Yes, politicians are probably with the public on this, and they actually say, look, we should just be doing it. It obviously is right. So forget about all these randomised controlled trials that everyone feels they need to be done. We can just do it and make it happen. And I think we'll see a huge amount of support, both on local politics and national.
Now, what's intriguing for me is that you're actually now employed by Natural England as a strategic health advisor, but you've also had a strategic health advisory role at the Met Office. So can you tell me a little bit about what was involved there?
Well, I suppose my fundamental kind of principles are on all of this is that we are connected to the environment, and the better we're connected, the healthier we become. And you isolate someone from a natural environment, from looking at sky, from looking at sun, from looking at trees and at birds and animals. If you take people away from that, they actually start to wilt very, very quickly. And the best example is in a kind of old people's home or some grimy Glasgow estate where people never move out from a concrete. And we now know from a big study in The Lancet that actually take away people from green space and outdoors and they die earlier. So the Met Office was the other part of the environment. It's the weather. And so we set up a service for patients who have something called COPD, which is chronic bronchitis and emphysema, who cost the NHS over £1 billion in unplanned admissions every year. So it's a lot of money. And a lot of these admissions can be prevented. But every time you talk to these patients, they say, yeah, well, doc, I know I'm doing all this stuff about prevention. But you know they're not. So it's very much like a diabetic not exercising. But when we linked it to the weather and gave them a forecast saying, actually, next week, you're much more at risk of being admitted to hospital than last week, we found they actually did all the things we'd asked them to do. And the reason was 95% of people with COPD believe very strongly that the weather affects their health. So it's a belief model they've got. And the fact the Met Office is sending out a forecast means it's not some pushy doctor or nurse telling them what to do. It's something they can relate to. And we've dropped admissions by 50% in virtually every area where it's gone to. It's now the whole of West Midlands Strategic Health Authority, the whole of the South West are now adopting this scheme. And it's a very simple concept of connecting people to the weather to actually reinforce messages.
What was your vision in 1994 that brought us to here? And, you know, is your vision being fulfilled or is there lots more to come? So, first off, what was the vision way back in 1994?
I did have a vision that there'd be walking schemes in every village, in every town, every community. I really believed that was... I had to aim for that in order to make some progress and have kept on pushing it. Although I went away for a few years at the Met Office, it was still being pushed very much in what is now Natural England. I felt that GPs would be very much more on board by now in 10 years, and they haven't. So that's one area of failure in many ways. But I think the public and the politicians have caught up, and I think it's unstoppable now that the whole natural environment and, of course, the credit crunch has helped that people's kind of soul searching of what actually do they really want in life. You know, what is it that makes us happy? What is it that is meaningful? And actually being brought up and being in contact with your environment and place, I think is that there's one key area now which people realise is important and they don't want to lose it.
OK, so what's the vision for the next 10 years?
We've got all the research we need to make a really strong case that the natural environment where people live is vital for their health and well-being, and without it, you cannot create health. Medicine will have shifted very much away from just the treatment, and there'll be whole new ways of delivering health promotion, which won't just be from the NHS, it will be from every other department, from local authority, from volunteers. Schools will have a big part to play, workplace will have a big part to play. All those people will be delivering health promotion and health prevention. And the NHS will probably be left just to do the disease part, which is where it has always been. I think we'll find that workplace, schools, GPs as well, communities, will all be very much more connect to where they live and want to look after it. So I don't think we'll see playing fields being sold off anymore. I think we'll see new regeneration of parks and green spaces. And I think the walking will become a fundamental kind of institution, and I'm hoping it will be, in every single community, but it won't be just on health walks. I think health walks were the kind of initiator. I think it won't even be called anything special, because it will become hopefully by then so normal for everyone that you won't need an organisation like Health Walks to actually keep driving it forward. It will just become much more part of the mainstream. So that's what I'd love to see. And we're setting up the Blue Gym, which is to look at the marine life and the water and lakes and canals, to get them very much more ingrained, because water's so important, and that will be a connection. The Green Gym, I think, will be very much more widespread. I think we'll have over 1,000 of those by 10 years' time. And I think we'll find that the medical profession will have accepted it with the evidence, and we're hoping that the Medical Research Council will actually get some money in very quickly. So it's a good place to be in 10 years.
So I have my suspicions that all that you're saying sounds really good, but there are issues out there which I think are jeopardise this vision, or may come along and slow it up a bit. And one of them I would have thought would be the fact that we seem to be wedded to our cars, and we're actually seeing declining numbers of journeys being made on foot. So how can one tackle the tough ones, the sort of car culture and also suburbia, which is pretty much designed for people to drive around,
yeah,
rather than walk around?
Well, that's not going to be an easy battle to win quickly, but using health as the main driver, I think it will be far better than using the environment. I think the environment has its limits for most people's kind of understanding. The environment is something out there. It doesn't affect taking my child to school and then going off to work and then having to get the shopping back again and then going to my gym. Those kind of thoughts, people's minds, are all about what their lifestyle is now. But if you said, and if it becomes very obvious from the local authority, from parents, from schools, that actually taking your child to school, although there may become, you know, the risk of being in a car is less being knocked over, the risk of actually having less intelligence, of your development withheld, having your immune system dropped, having your growth impeded, all of those things can happen if you don't do enough exercise or go out or be sociable. And I think as that evidence comes, people are going to shift because they want the best for their children. And then I think with public pressure, the shift, people will own cars, but they just won't use them perhaps as much. But it will be ever so slow. People have still remember their grandparents walking to work, and therefore for them now to have a car is a success. And that culture has to go through a cycle of a couple of generations before it starts to become a nuisance and a problem rather than the solution.
So, William, you mentioned you've got your father. How many children have you got?
I've got three children.
And what's their age are they now?
So three of them, 11, 16, two boys and a girl.
Do they take a deep sigh when Dad comes home and he says we're off for a walk?
I don't do that. Wouldn't dream of it. Yes, we used to take lots of family walks when they were younger, but now in their teens, we don't inflict it. I do run with them. We do a lot of outdoor activity, and my youngest is very, very keen on her pony, and so she does pretty much all her exercise. So, no, we don't do loads of family walks. It's only if they really want to. We do make sure is that they're outdoors a lot, and I think that's all that really matters. People often say, oh, it's all to do with PlayStations and Xbox, and I think actually that's an excuse. I think for children, they will always want to go on PlayStations and Xboxes, but what we have to do is give them a balance and opportunity and encouragement to be outdoors. And I hope to think that ours, although they do play their computers a lot, they're outdoors an awful lot. There's not any lack of outdoors because of the computers, it's because we've given them the encouragement and hopefully set them right from an early age of the enjoyment of being outdoors. But it's hard work, and there's this whole worry about risk, that people think the outdoors is risky. Well, there is a slight risk of children falling out of trees and hurting themselves, and perhaps on a bike being knocked over by a car. But we know there's a definite risk, and in fact it's not even a risk, it's an absolute certainty, that if children aren't outdoors as they're growing up, they're deprived. They're deprived emotionally, and then deprived environmental intelligence really is going to be withdrawn, and there'll be lesser people. And I think that's the message we need to put across.
You're saying that it's just getting out and about rather than laying on activities for them.
What I love seeing is when they're just being outdoors and just experiencing it and enjoying it. Someone said, you know, they said, William, you're far too much concentrating on human doing rather than human being. It's just that being outdoors that is important, and I agree. I think the formal exercise, sport, etc. is great, but we mustn't rely on that, because that does physical activity only and a bit of social, but there's a whole environmental aspect of just people being experiencing away from parents, a bit of risk, wildish areas. That is what really gives the resilience to children as they become adults. And that's the evidence that's been shown. The children who don't get that experience by the age of 13 are pretty much lost for the rest of their lives, and that's fairly scary.
Can you recommend any particular walks that you favour, or do you have a particular favourite route?
When people used to import stuff up to Oxford from the Thames, they used to have to unload it at a Henley and take it on wagons across to Wallingford, because around Reading and Sonning the river was too shallow. So there was this lane called the Pack and Prime Lane, which went between Wallingford and Henley. You can join it at Rotherfield Peppard and take it to Henley. And it's still in this valley. It's got loads of pubs normally all along that route for obvious reasons. Most of them called the Highwayman and Gallows Tree. But the bit I take from Peppard to Henley is completely tranquil. Virtually just two houses you see, just 4 miles out of Reading, 25 miles out of London. And you've got this tranquil 4 miles of track, and I'd say that was my favourite.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities in London. In this episode, you've heard from Dr. William Bird. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we would love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the talkingwalking.net website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stark of Rethinking Cities, our graphic artwork was designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music was composed and recorded by Simon Sanders at Easytronic.